Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Thursday, June 13th. I'm Stephen Overly. I have something embarrassing to admit, and I hope Canadians are too nice to send me hate mail about it. But if you asked me to name a major Canadian tech brand, the first one that comes to mind is BlackBerry. You know, the company that pioneered the smartphone and then got totally crushed by Apple and Google. I know that's very American of me, and there are well-known names like Shopify, the e-commerce platform, but Canada hasn't exactly been seen as a tech powerhouse on the world stage. Well, until artificial intelligence came along. Canada boasts having over 140,000 AI professionals and 10% of the world's top-tier AI researchers, putting it second to the US. Now, other countries like China might challenge that claim to fame, but I do know Canada is home to some of the field's visionaries, like Geoffrey Hinton, Yoshua Bengio, and Richard Sutton. And there are Canadians throughout US tech companies too. Like just a few weeks ago, I met the vice president of AI research at Meta, a woman named Joelle Pinault, who was visiting Washington from Montreal. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wants to turn all that brain power into a new generation of Canadian tech companies. And he's proposed spending nearly $2.5 billion to do it. The big AI ambitions on both sides of the border was the subject of a panel I moderated a couple days ago at the U.S.-Canada Summit in Toronto, an event hosted by BMO Financial Group and Eurasia Group. And the lineup was solid. Martin Kahn, the chief operating officer of an AI company called Cohere, Anna Makanju, the vice president of global affairs at OpenAI, Christina Montgomery, the chief privacy and trust officer at IBM, and Jordan Jacobs, the co-founder and managing partner at venture capital firm Radical Ventures. So rather than replay that conversation in full, I wanted to break out some of the most interesting points. First up, the competition between the US and Canada. Both want to be AI power players, both see a lot of upside to AI in terms of solving big problems like climate change, but both are also vying for a relatively small pool of tech talent and startups. Martin's company, Cohere, has headquarters in Toronto and San Francisco. In his view, competition between companies is good, not so much between governments.
And competition is good because competition spurs innovation. I would posit that the U.S. is an incredible place for tech. I spent many years there myself. Many Canadians have left Canada to go and work there and had amazing success. But with AI, a lot of the birth of modern AI has come out of Canada. And one of the things that we as Cohere wanted to do is have a company set up here where a lot of the talent comes from, and have an opportunity to commercialize that talent, those capabilities, as a global company that is very present here, but that also, as you said, has strong presence in San Francisco, in New York, and in London, where the talent is. And so competition, I think, is fantastic. It's just important, as with any technology, that you think about what it is that you're trying to do and not try and just be a me too. We, as a company, we have no consumer chatbot. We are enterprise only. But I think certainly between Canada and the US, there shouldn't be competition. It's not like we're Canadian competing with the US. We're also American. I'm actually, American now with my red, white, and blue socks, despite having been born and grown up and educated in Canada. So I think the more we can make this seamless transition or interaction across the borders, whether that's using compute in the right place, whether that's harmonizing our copyright laws or the policies around liability, whether it's making flow of labor in both directions more easy, whether it's being each other's customers. How can the various governments be each other's customers of this technology? I think there's a lot that we can do together to build the ecosystem overall and allow companies to compete on their merits and choosing the areas they want to focus on.
Okay, so Martin said Canada and the U.S. should play nice. But Prime Minister Trudeau was on another tech podcast recently, Hard Fork, from the New York Times, with a slightly different message. He said Canada has a lot of advantages, including cleaner energy, more favorable immigration laws, and better quality of life. Jordan talks to entrepreneurs all the time for Radical Ventures. When I asked him about competitive advantages, he told me people want to follow the tech talent.
I was running an AI company before we sold it to focus on building an institutional investor. We had this challenge of we would go recruit people from Mountain View or from DeepMind in London, and they would say, look, I'm prepared to quit my job, and so is my spouse, and we're going to pull the kids from school and pay the exit tax and move to Canada. But if it doesn't work out with you, there's no other jobs in AI. I'm talking about 2015, 16, 17. So you need a critical mass of talent in order to attract more talent, in order to attract the companies that then create the ecosystem of jobs that the next person knows if they go there and it doesn't work out with the first place, there's 50 or 100 or 1,000 other opportunities. So I think that at a baseline, you need the talent pool to attract other talent. And what really smart people in this field want is to work with other really smart people. So I think that's more important than what the weather is, what my taxes are, you know, any of the other, you know, how close cottage country is. It's much more about, I want to be with the smartest people in the world doing the most ambitious things. And so if you can create the ecosystem that can support that, everything else follows.
The second point is really about safety, but that's a pretty vague term in the AI conversation. Fundamentally, the panel agreed AI will really only be widely adopted if people trust it and think it's not going to harm and deceive them. Christina from IBM said getting there requires countries to work together. And as she sees it, they're on the right track.
We're obviously a global company. We have operations in 170 countries around the world. So for us, having interoperable, not the same regulation, but interoperability around regulation is really important. And I do think that there is a lot in terms of interoperability and more to come in terms of the harmonization of laws between Canada and the US. And I also am encouraged by the creation or the announcement of the creation of the Canadian Safety Institute. The US has one, Canada has one, other countries are developing those. Because even if the regulatory approach is different, the law is different, for me, now I'm speaking on policy, but I'm also responsible for our compliance program across the company. And so for me, the way we think about it is we need to distill, if we look across all of these global laws and regulations and we distill them down to what are the commonalities among all of them. They're all fairly common when you think about things like risk management systems and quality data and transparency elements and that type of thing. And where things are going to play out in the future are around the standards. Like, okay, we talk about transparency. What do we mean by that in reality? What will suffice? What documentation will suffice, for example? So I think there's a lot of work that's left to be done. I actually think AI may turn out to be a poster child for how to do it right. I'm hoping and encouraged because, and others may disagree, but like I hear a lot of conversation around countries and around the safety institutes and standards bodies, all trying to figure out together, how do we do this, right? How do we build trust in the technology, leverage the potential of the technology in ways that are consistent with that trust and support the real potential for innovation, that AI for innovation, for productivity improvements, for improving quality of life for people, right? But we have to do it with technology that's trusted. And so conversations are happening in the AI space like I've never seen happen in a coordinated way across any other topic that I can think of in the past.
All right. But until that regulation is in place, companies will largely have to police themselves. And many see that as a risky proposition. OpenAI has faced its share of scrutiny for how fast it's rolling out AI models and questions about the safeguards it has in place. I asked Anna whether OpenAI had learned any lessons from the past, particularly screw-ups that caused social media companies to lose public trust.
Well, I think that the good news is that we've learned an enormous number of lessons from exactly the cycle that you're talking about. So this is something that we have built in from the outset. We were thinking about these safety concerns from the beginning of model development through its deployment, and then there's an iterative process constantly to improve the models and make them safer. And you've seen each successive model become safer and safer. And research that's really, for example, we pioneered a technique called reinforcement learning from human feedback. And you know, one really big distinction between, let's say, GPT-3 and 4 is GPT-4 can refuse to engage in behavior. The GPT-3 was not able to do that. So we're constantly like pioneering new techniques to make these models safer. In general, you know, when we have GPT-4, for example, we spent 8 months red teaming it, bringing people to really think about like what are the ways that people can abuse it. And that is, you know, long before we deployed into the world. And you have seen us actually not deploy things at all to the public. For example, Voice Engine, which is a state-of-the-art audio method where with 15 seconds of someone's voice, we can instantaneously replicate their voice and the, you know, say whatever that person will, you know, use that person's voice to essentially say anything in any language. And we developed this technology maybe a year and a half ago, which is like 1 million years in AI time.
Yeah.
And we didn't deploy it, even though there are very vast commercial applications. We've used it with some trusted partners, actually some really amazing cases like helping people restore a voice who have lost it through for some really serious chronic diseases, et cetera. But it's not publicly deployed because we think there's still a long ways to go to make sure that it's actually safe to deploy to the public. Same with Sora, which is, you know, the video generation model, which we previewed just so that people understand this is where the state of the art is, but we have not publicly released it. So we are definitely making these decisions very deliberately.
Finally, we had to talk about business. I've been covering tech for quite some time now, and I know that companies tend to talk about the technology they make in sweeping and selfless terms. But at the end of the day, they're out to make money, the same as any other company. But with AI raising all of these societal concerns about job loss and economic inequality, and even war, I asked Jordan whether investors and business leaders need to be thinking differently now. Jordan said his firm already is.
So our motivation was, let's go support the kinds of companies that are doing things to cure cancer and build language models and, you know, change the world for the good. It depends on the individual investor. Our view was, if we pick problems that are big enough that we think this technology can help solve, you do good and you also make a ton of money for your investors. Our performance is proving that to our investors. And then the way that you make those decisions, I think, can be influenced by the way you're thinking. So, for example, in all of our term sheets, we've always put in an obligation for the companies to think about responsible AI. Initially, the law firms that represent most of the tech companies would cross it out. We've never seen this before. What is this? What are you doing? We use internally a framework when we're evaluating AI companies. Where's the data coming from? Is the data broad enough to not create a bias in the data that's going to actually result in bad outcomes that the customers won't like? And so we think of that as a risk. It's a risk as an investor, right? And part of what we're trying to do is always quantify risks. So we created a framework that essentially elucidated a huge number of things to think about as an investor. We open sourced it. Hilariously, a bunch of firms jumped all over us and said, you're terrible and you want to slow things down. That's not all what we want to do. We just want people to have the benefit of, you know, we were the first Western investors in AI, and we wanted people to be thinking about, here are all the different things that you should consider, and you can score them however you want, but here's how we score them, and here's how we think about the elements of them that and the risk that they create. So I think it's down to the individual investors. Some will just invest in things that they think will make the most money. Some will invest in things that they also think has a benefit to the world. There's people in between. So I don't think there's a, you know, like with the rest of the world, there's not a uniform approach to it. But I think there are a lot of people being responsible in the way they're thinking about it, in their engagement with the companies that they're investing in, and then also engagement with the wider ecosystem of industry, of government, et cetera, and trying to lead the organizations that are learning in the right direction.
You know, as I was listening to the panelists talk, I kept waiting for the sales pitch. With four business people on stage, it's bound to happen. And sure enough, Martin and Anna both went for it, but with a bit of a spin. They want more governments to buy AI, and they say it's because using the technology firsthand will improve public trust and lead to better regulation. Here's Martin and then Anna.
So I think it's very important. And one of the things that I would say, I think we have many policymakers and government officials here, become customers. The way you're going to have trust is, it is very important to have the right guardrails. So I don't want to downplay that at all. But it would be great if we also talk about all the great advancements this technology can bring, in addition to going straight to safety institutes and risks and so on. Yes, we need to think about those carefully. But I would think the best way to figure out how to do things safely is start to deploy it in production at scale in low-risk ways. For example, how do you get better information on filling out your taxes from the IRS or CRA? How can you get information about, you know, renewing your driver's license at the DMV so you don't waste 3 hours because you brought the wrong stuff? None of that's going to change the world, but it does do a couple of things. One, it forces companies like ours, but also the deployers themselves, to go through all the yucky stuff that no one writes articles about. How much compute do you need? What's the latency? You know, what are the data access rights that you have to set up and all these things to make it work, you know, behind the scenes? And secondly, it builds trust. If the citizenry is now delighted saying, I know how to get a visa, you know, from the US consulate, you know, I just got the information so much easier. This just saved me an hour. Then they start thinking about all the other things that it can do. So I think that the single best thing that governments can do is become customers, deploy this stuff, and show that it's actually positive, and develop the trust that this is actually a really helpful technology.
I do think that governments are, of course, it's very critical that they figure out the guardrails, but Martin said this previously, which is that governments using it, not partly because they will create like very good use cases, but also this is really about ensuring equal access. And governments are the biggest distributor of services to people. This technology, ultimately, part of it is it just does a lot of boring things, but it makes you more productive. Moderna, for example, they use it for a lot of boring things, but it means that they can accelerate clinical trials. Their clinical trials are taking them 20% of the amount of time they used to take before they started integrating our models. Every single government agency could do this, and we've seen this already. You know, we have a pilot with this organization called Digital Green that does smallholder farmer support in Kenya and India. They have been able to cut the cost of serving each farmer by 100x per year. So imagine like what that means for service delivery, but also for governments to understand like where are the actual risks. Where are the limitations? Where are the benefits? They're the ones that are going to regulate and oversee this technology. So the more they use it, the more they understand it, and the more they're able to leverage it for delivering to citizens.
Well, that was my conversation in Toronto, and that's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.